In 1984, a paper was presented describing a man who firmly believed himself to have two heads. He found one of them irritating beyond endurance and shot at it with a revolver, injuring himself terribly in the process. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic, and the psychiatric community agreed, since it was manifestly certain that the man only had one head and suffered from and was dominated by an absurd delusion. But then again, the notorious Mad Lucas of Victorian Hertfordshire, who lived with his wife's dead body for 3 months and then by himself in wild biblical solitude and squalor for the next quarter century, and who was visited by coachloads of day-trippers up from London, he was diagnosed as schizophrenic too. Should he have been? Was he not merely a borderline eccentric, behaving in a fashion beyond the accepted norms? Was he as mad as the deluded owner of the phantom head? Was he as dangerous and as deserving of confinement? And how does a case like William Miner's sit within the spectrum of this madness? Was he less mad than the first man, and more so than the second? How does one quantify? How does one treat? How does one judge? Psychiatrists today remain cautious about all of these questions, and puzzled and argumentative about whether the illness can be triggered, whether it does have a definable cause. Most academic psychiatrists hedge their bets, avoiding dogma, preferring simply to say that they believe in the cumulative effect of a number of factors. A patient may have a simple genetic predisposition to the illness, or characteristics of the person's basic temperament may similarly increase the likelihood that he or she will react badly or floridly to an external stress, to the sights of a battlefield, to the shock of a torture, for example. And then again, maybe certain sights and the shocks are too great or too sudden for anyone to endure them and to remain wholly sane. There's the recently recognized condition known as post-traumatic stress disorder, which seems to affect inordinately large numbers of people who have been exposed to truly appalling situations. The only difference between their cases today, after the Gulf War, where it was first identified en masse, or after the trauma of a kidnap or a traffic accident, is that most sufferers are relieved of their symptoms after a period of time. But William Chester Miner never was. His agony endured for his entire life. However convenient it may be to say that post-traumatic stress ruined his life and that of his victim, the continuing symptoms suggest otherwise. There was something wildly wrong with his brain, and what happened in Virginia probably prompted its more ruinous manifestations to emerge. Perhaps it was an unusual genetic makeup that predisposed him to fall ill. Two of his relations, remember, had killed themselves, though we're not certain of the circumstances. Maybe his gentle temperament, he was a painter, a flautist, a collector of old books, made him unusually vulnerable to what he saw and felt on those blood-soaked fields in the South. Maybe his subsequent imprisonment in Broadmoor then left him unimproved, when a more compassionate and enlightened regime might have mitigated his darker feelings, might have helped him recover. 1 in 100 people today suffer from schizophrenia, nearly all of them, if treated with compassion and good chemistry, can have some kind of dignified life, of a kind that was denied for much of his time to Dr. Miner. Except, of course, that Miner had his dictionary work. And there's a cruel irony in this, that if he had been so treated, he might never have felt impelled to work on it as he did. By offering him mood-altering sedatives, as they would have done in Edwardian times, or treating him as today with such antipsychotic drugs as quetiapine or risperidone, many of his symptoms of madness might have gone away, but he might well have felt disinclined or unable to perform his work for Dr. Murray. In a sense, doing all those dictionary slips was his medication. In a way, they became his therapy. The routine of his quiet and cell-bound intellectual stimulus month upon month, year upon year, appears to have provided him with at least a measure of release from his paranoia. His sad situation only worsened when that stimulus was gone, when the great book ceased to function as his lodestone, when the one fixed point on which his remarkable but tortured brain was able to concentrate became detached. So then he began to spiral downwards, and his life began to ebb. One must, therefore, feel a sense of strange gratitude that his treatment was never good enough to divert him from his work. The agonies that he must have suffered in those terrible asylum nights have granted us all a benefit, and for all time. He was mad, and for that we've reason to be glad. A truly savage irony, and one on which it's perhaps discomforting to dwell. In November 1915, 4 months after Sir James had died, Dr. Minor wrote to Lady Murray in Oxford, offering her all the books that had been sent from Broadmoor to the scriptorium and that had been in Sir James's possession when he died. He hoped they might eventually go off to the Bodleian Library. "I'm glad to know that you're well, as I must presume from your letter and occupations. You must be taking or giving a great deal of labour for dictionary materials still." He uses the English spelling of words here. Clearly his years in Broadmoor had left their mark in more ways than the merely custodial. And his books do indeed rest in the great Oxford Library to this day. They are registered as having been donated by Dr. Minor through Lady Murray. But by now he was failing steadily. An old colleague from Civil War days wrote from West Chester, Pennsylvania, to ask how his friend was, and the hospital superintendent replies that, considering his years, Captain Minor is in good health and is in a bright and cheerful ward where he seems contented with his surroundings. But the ward notes tell a different story, presenting as they do a litany of all the symptoms of the steady onset of senility and dementia. With increasing frequency, the attendants write of Minor stumbling, injuring himself, getting lost, losing his temper, wandering, growing dizzy, tiring easily, and worst of all, beginning to forget, and knowing that he was forgetting. His mind, though tortured, had always been peculiarly acute. Now, by 1918 and the end of the Great War, he seemed to know that his faculties were dimming, that his mind was at last becoming as weakened as his body, and that the sands were running out. For days at a time he'd stay in bed, saying he needed a good rest. He'd barricade the door with chairs, still certain he was being persecuted. It was more than 45 years since the murder, fully half a century since the first signs of madness had been noticed back at that Florida army fort, and yet still the symptoms remained the same, persistent, uncured, incurable. Still came the occasional querulous note, such as this, written in the summer of 1917. "Dr. White, dear sir, there was a time when the meat, beef and ham, was very tough and dry. This has in a degree altered for the better since your note even, and I would not complain of that, and rice seemed to be the only vegetable with it. This is not much to complain of, and yet these trifles are much to us in this life. Thanking you for what you would wish to do, I am very truly yours, W.C. Minor." A year later, though his failing memory and eyesight cause him to date the letter 1819 rather than 1918, he shows another strange spurt of benevolence, similar to his contributing to James Murray's adventures to the Cape. In this latest case, he sent $25 to the Belgian Relief Fund, and a further $25 to Yale University, his alma mater, as a donation to its military service fund. The president of Yale wrote back from Woodbridge Hall, "I've known much of Dr. Minor's history," he replied to the superintendent, "and I'm therefore doubly touched to receive his gift." In 1919, his nephew Edward Minor applied to the army to have him released from St. Elizabeth's and brought to a hospital for the elderly and sane in Hartford, Connecticut, known as the Retreat. The army agreed. "I think if the Retreat fully understands the case, we should let him go," said a Dr. Duval at an October conference to discuss the matter. "He's getting so old now, he will probably not do much harm." The hospital board agreed too, and in November, in a snowstorm, the frail old gentleman left Washington and the strange world of insane asylums, a world he had inhabited since 1872, for good and for ever. He liked his new home, a mansion set in acres of woods and gardens on the banks of the Connecticut River. His nephew wrote in the early winter of 1920 of how the change seemed to have done him some good, and yet at the same time how incapable he was of looking after himself. Furthermore, he was fast going blind, and for some months had been unable to read. With this one overarching source of joy now denied to him, there must have seemed to him little left to live for. No one was surprised when, after a walk on a blustery early spring day in that same year, he caught a cold that turned into bronchopneumonia and died peacefully in his sleep. It was Friday, March the 26th, 1920. He had lived for 85 years and 9 months. He might have been mad, but like Dr. Johnson's dictionary elephant, he had been extremely long-lifed. There were no obituaries, just two lines in the deaths columns of the New Haven Register. He was taken down to his old hometown and buried in the Evergreen Cemetery on the afternoon of the following Monday in the family plot that had been established by his missionary father, Eastman Strongminer. The gravestone is small and undistinguished, made of reddish sandstone, and bears only his name, William Chester Minor. An angel stands on a plinth nearby, gazing skyward, with the engraved motto, "My faith looks up to thee." Around the Evergreen Cemetery, a high chain-link fence keeps out an angry part of New Haven, well away from the stern elegance of Yale. The simple existence of the fence underlines a sad and ironic reality. Dr. William Minor, who was among the greatest of contributors to the finest dictionary in all the English language, died forgotten in obscurity and is buried beside a slum. The Oxford English Dictionary itself took another 8 years to finish, the announcement of its completion made on New Year's Eve, 1927. The New York Times put the fact on the front page the next morning, a Sunday, that with the inclusion of the old Kentish word zixt, the second indicative present tense in local argot of the verb to see, the work was done, the alphabet was exhausted, and the full text was now wholly in the printer's hands. The making of the great book, declared the newspaper roundly and generously, was one of the great romances of English literature. The Americans did indeed love the story of its making. H. L. Mencken, no mean lexicographer himself, wrote that he fully expected Oxford to celebrate the culmination of the 70-year project with military exercises, boxing matches between the dons, orations in Latin, Greek, English, and the Oxford dialect, yelling matches between the different colleges, and a series of medieval drinking bouts. Considering that the final editor of the book was dividing his time between professorships at both Oxford and Chicago, there was more than good reason for Americans to take a keen interest in a creation that was now, at least partly, of their own making. The lonely drudgery of lexicography, the terrible undertow of words against which men like Murray and Minor had so ably struggled and stood, now had at last its great reward. 12 mighty volumes, 414,825 words defined, 1,827,306 illustrative quotations used, to which William Minor alone had contributed scores of thousands. The total length of type, all handset, for the books were done by letterpress, still discernible in the delicately impressed feel of the inked-on paper, is 178 miles, the distance between London and the outskirts of Manchester. Discounting every punctuation mark and every space, which any printer knows occupied just as much time to set as does a single letter, there are no fewer than 227,779,589 letters and numbers. Other dictionaries in other languages took longer to make, but none was greater, grander, or had more authority than this. The greatest effort since the invention of printing, the longest sensational serial ever written. One word, and only one word, was ever actually lost. Bondmaid, which appears in Johnson's dictionary, was actually mislaid by Murray and was found astray without a home long after the fascicle Latently to Bosom had been published. It, and tens of thousands of words that had evolved or appeared during the 44 years spent assembling the fascicles and their parent volumes, appeared in a supplement, which came out in 1933. Four further supplements appeared between 1972 and 1986. In 1989, using the new abilities of the computer, Oxford University Press issued its fully integrated second edition, incorporating all the changes and additions of the supplements into 20 rather more slender volumes. To help boost sales in the late 70s, a two-volume set in much reduced typeface was issued, a powerful magnifying glass included in every slipcase. Then came a CD-ROM, and not long afterward, the great work was further adapted for use online. A third edition with a vast budget was in the works. There's some occasional carping that the work reflects an elitist, male, British, Victorian tone. Yet even in the admission that, like so many achievements of the era, it did reflect a set of attitudes not wholly harmonic with those prevalent at the end of the 20th century, none seem to suggest that any other dictionary has ever come close, or will ever come close, to the achievement that it offers. It was the heroic creation of a legion of interested and enthusiastic men and women of wide general knowledge and interest, and it lives on today just as lives the language of which it rightly claims to be a portrait. Postscript. Memorial, adjective and noun. Preserving the memory of a person or thing. Something by which the memory of a person, thing, or event is preserved as a monumental erection. This has been the story of an American soldier, whose involvement in the making of the world's greatest dictionary was singular, astonishing, memorable, and laudable, and yet at the same time wretchedly sad. And in the telling, it's tempting to forget that the circumstances that placed William Chester Minor in the position in which he was able to contribute all his time and energy to the making of the OED began with his horrible and unforgivable commission of a murder. George Merritt, who was his victim, was an ordinary, innocent, working-class farmer's son from Wiltshire, who came up to London to make his living, but who was shot dead, leaving a pregnant wife, Eliza, and seven young children. The family was already living in the direst poverty, trying to maintain some semblance of their farm country dignity amid the squalor of one of the roughest and most unforgiving parts of the Victorian city. With Merritt's murder, matters took a terrible turn for the worse. All London was shocked and horrified by the killing, and funds were raised and money collected to help the widow and her brood. Americans in particular, stunned by the outrage committed by one of their own, were asked by their consul general to contribute to a diplomatic fund. The vicars in Lambeth banded together to make collections, ecumenically. A series of amateur entertainments, including one of an unusually high-class character, with readings of Longfellow and of a selection from Othello and held at the Hercules Club, were staged across town to raise money. And the funeral itself was a splendid affair, as impressive as that of any grandee. George Merritt had been a member of the Ancient Order of Foresters, one of the many so-called friendly societies that were once popular across Britain, as a means, in the absence of any government or privately funded schemes, of providing cooperative pensions and other financial help for the working classes. On the night he died, Merritt had been relieving a shift worker who was a brother forester. This small act of benevolence doubly obliged the order to offer its late member a handsome farewell. The cortege was half a mile long. The foresters' band, playing the Dead March from Saul, came first, then scores of emblem-wearing members, then the horse-drawn hearse and four black mourning coaches, to carry the bereaved. Eliza Merritt rode in the lead carriage, holding her youngest baby in her arms and sobbing. Hundreds of brewery workers followed, and then thousands of ordinary members of the public, all wearing black crepe bands around their arms or hats. For the entire afternoon, the procession wound from Lambeth, past the spot on Belvedere Road where the tragedy had occurred, past the Bedlam Hospital, and up to the vast cemetery at Tooting, where George Merritt was finally buried. His grave may once have been marked, but it lacks a marker now, and where the records say George Merritt lies, there is no more than a patch of discoloured grass, a tiny patch of settled earth among a sea of nobler and newer monuments. As we have seen, in his lucid moments William Minor was contrite, appalled by the consequences of his moment of mad delusion. From his cells at Broadmoor he saw to it that money was sent to the family to help them in their distress. His stepmother, Judith, had already arranged gifts for the children. Some 7 years after the tragedy, when Minor wrote to express his remorse, Eliza Merritt said that she forgave him, and she made what now seems the extraordinary decision to visit him in Broadmoor, and indeed for some months came down to Crowthorne frequently and brought him packages of his beloved books. But she never really recovered from the shock of what had happened. Before long she had taken to drink, and when she died it was of liver failure. Two of her sons' lives then unravelled most curiously. George, the second oldest boy, took Judith's gift of money to Monaco, won a considerable sum and remained there, styling himself the King of Monte Carlo, before dying in impoverished obscurity in the south of France. His younger brother Frederick shot himself dead in London for reasons that have never been fully explained. The fact that two of Minor's brothers also died by their own hand invests this entire story with almost more sadness than is bearable. But the principal tragic figure in this strange tale is the man who is the least well remembered, the one who was gunned down on the damp and cold cobblestones of Lambeth on that Saturday night in February 1872. The only public memorials ever raised to the two most tragically linked of this saga's protagonists are miserable, niggardly affairs. William Miner has just a simple little gravestone in a New Haven cemetery, hemmed in between litter and slums. George Merritt has for years had nothing at all, except for a patch of greyish grass in a sprawling graveyard in South London. Miner does, however, have the advantage of the Great Dictionary, which some might say acts as his most lasting remembrance. But nothing else remains to suggest that the man he killed was ever worthy of any memory at all. George Merritt has become an absolutely unsung man. Which is why it now seems fitting, more than a century and a quarter on, that this modest account begins with the dedication that it does, and why this book is offered as a small testament to the late George Merritt of Wiltshire and Lambeth, without whose untimely death these events would never have unfolded, and this tale could never have been told. Author's note. Coda. In music, a passage of more or less independent character, introduced after the completion of the essential parts of a movement, so as to form a more definite and satisfactory conclusion. I first became intrigued by the central figure of this story, the dictionary itself, back in the early 1980s, when I was living in Oxford. One summer's day, a friend who worked at the University Press invited me into a warehouse to look at a forgotten treasure. It was a jumbled pile of metal plates, each one measuring a little more than 7 inches by 10, and, as I found when I picked one up, as heavy as the devil. They were the discarded letterpress printing plates from which the Oxford English Dictionary had been made. The original lead-fronted, steel- and antimony-backed plates, cast in the 19th and early 20th centuries, from which all the many printings of the OED, from the individual fascicles made as the books were being edited, to the final 12-volume masterpiece of 1928, had been made. The press, my friend explained, had recently adopted more modern methods, computer typesetting, photolithography, and the like. The old ways of the letterpress men, with their slugs of lead and their typesticks, their M-quads and their brasses and coppers, their timpan paper and their plate and brushes, and their uncanny ability to read backwards and upside down at speed, were at long last being abandoned. The plates and all the job cases of type for handsetting were now being tossed away, melted down, carried off. Would I perhaps like one or two of the plates, he asked me, just to keep as souvenirs of something that had once been rather marvellous. I chose three of them, reading the backwards type as best I could in the dim and dusty light. Two of them I later gave away, but I kept one. It was the complete page 452 of the Great Dictionary's Volume 5. It encompassed the words humeral to humour. It had been edited in 1901 or so, and set in type in 1902. For years I took this strange, dirty-looking old plate around with me. It was a kind of talisman. I'd squirrel it away in cupboards in the various flats and houses in the various cities and villages in which I came to live. I was rather proud of it, boringly so, I dare say, and every so often I'd find it hidden behind other more important things, and I would bring it out, blow off the dust, and show it off to friends, a small and fascinating item of lexicographic history. I'm sure at first they thought I was a little mad, though in truth I fancy they seemed after a while to understand my odd affection for the blackened and so heavy little thing. I'd watch as they rubbed their fingers gently over its raised lead, and nod in mute agreement. The plate seemed to offer them some kind of tactile pleasure, as well as a simpler intellectual amusement. When I came to live in the United States in the mid-90s, I met a letterpress printer, a woman named Carol Blinn, who lived in Western Massachusetts. I told her about the plate, and she became visibly excited. Carol had a great enthusiasm for the story of the making of the dictionary, she said, as well as a tremendous fondness for its design, for the elegant and clever mix of typography and font sizes the stern old Victorian editors had employed. She asked to see my plate, and when I brought it to her, she asked if she might borrow it for a while. That while turned into 2 long years, during which time she took on as much other work as a hand printer gets these days. She embarked on a series of broadsides for John Updike, made chapbooks for a couple of other New England poets, published a collection or two of short stories and plays, all of which she had printed on handmade paper. She was very much the craftswoman, all her work meticulous, slow, and perfect, and she kept my dictionary plate standing on a windowsill all the while, wondering what best to do with it. Finally, she decided. Carol knew that I had a great liking for China and had lived there for many years, and that I was also fonder of Oxford than of any other English city. So she took down the plate, she washed it carefully in a range of solvents to purge it of its accumulated dust, grease, and ink, mounted it on her Vandercook proof printer, and carefully pressed on the finest hand-woven paper two editions of the page, one inked in Oxford blue, the other in China red. She then mounted the three items side by side, the metal plate in the middle, the red page to the left, the other blue page to the right, and set them inside a slender gold frame behind non-reflecting glass. She left the completed picture with wire and bracket for hanging it on the wall in a small cafe in her hometown, and then wrote a postcard telling me to pick it up whenever I could, and at the same time to take care to enjoy the cafe owner's strawberry rhubarb pie and her cappuccino. There was no bill, and I've never seen the printer since. But the plate and its proof sheets hang on my walls still, above a small lamp that illuminates an open volume of the great dictionary on the desk below. It is volume 5, and I keep it open to the same page that was once printed from the actual piece of metal that hangs suspended just above it. It's what Victorians would have called a grand conjunction, and it serves as a small shrine to the pleasures of bookmaking and printing, and to the joy of words. Once my mother noticed that the dominant entry on the plate and the sheets and in the book below is the word humorist. It reminded her of a nicely droll coincidence, another conjunction, though one rather less grand. Humorist had been the name of a horse that ran in the Derby on June 1, 1921, the day my mother was born. Her father, so pleased at the news of the birth of a baby girl, had put 10 guineas on the filly, rank outsider though she was. But she won, and a grandfather I never met made 1,000 guineas, and all because of a word that briefly took his fancy. Acknowledgements. Acknowledgement, noun, the act of acknowledging, confessing, admitting, or owning. Confession, avowal. The owning of a gift or benefit received, or of a message, grateful, courteous, or due recognition. Hence, the sensible sign whereby anything received is acknowledged, something given or done in return for a favour or message, or a formal communication that we have received it. When I first came upon this story, which was mentioned all too briefly and just as an aside, in a rather sober book about the dictionary-making craft, it struck me immediately as a tale well worth investigating and perhaps telling in full. But for several months I was alone in thinking so. I had in the works a truly massive project about an altogether different subject, and the advice from virtually all sides was that I should press on with that and leave this amusing little saga well alone. But 4 people did find it just as fascinating as I did, and saw also the possibilities that by telling the poignant and human tale of William Minor, I could perhaps create some kind of prism through which to view the greater and even more fascinating story of the history of English lexicography. These 4 people were Bill Hamilton, my long-time friend and London agent, Anya Washington, my editor at Viking, also in London, Larry Ashmead, executive editor of HarperCollins in New York, and Marisa Milanese, then an editorial assistant in the offices of Condé Nast Traveller magazine, also in New York. Their faith in this otherwise unregarded project was total and unremitting, and I thank them for it unreservedly. Marisa, whom I think a paragon of ceaseless enthusiasm, dogged initiative, and untiring zeal, then went on to help me with the American end of the research. Together with my close friend of a quarter century, Juliet Walker, in London, she helped me spin my basic ideas into a complex web of facts and figures, which I've since attempted to settle into some kind of coherent order. The extent to which I have succeeded or failed in this I cannot yet judge, but I should say here that these 2 women presented me with a bottomless well of information, and if I have misinterpreted, misread, misheard, or miswritten any of it, then those mistakes are my responsibility, and mine alone. My thanks also to Sue Llewellyn, who, as well as copy-editing this book so assiduously and with such good humour also, she reminded me, had worked on my book on career, 10 years before. Access to Broadmoor Special Hospital and to the voluminous files that they've long kept on all patients was clearly going to be the key to cracking the story, and it took some weeks before Juliet Walker and I were allowed in. That we were was a triumph for two Broadmoor employees, Paul Robertson and Alison Webster, who made a persuasive case on our behalf to a perhaps understandably reluctant hospital administration. Without the help of these two remarkable and kind individuals, this book would never have managed to be much more than a collection of conjectures. The Broadmoor files were needed to provide the facts, and Paul and Alison provided the files. On the other side of the Atlantic, matters proceeded rather differently, despite the best efforts of the splendid Marisa. St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. is no longer a federal institution, but is run by the government of the District of Columbia, a government that has experienced some well-publicized troubles in recent years. And at first, perhaps because of this, the hospital refused point-blank to release any of its files, and went so far as to suggest quite seriously that I engage a lawyer and sue in order to obtain them. However, some while later, a cursory search I made one day of the National Archives pages on the World Wide Web suggested to me that the papers relating to Dr. Miner, who had been a patient at St. Elizabeth's between 1910 and 1919, when the institution was undeniably under federal jurisdiction, might well be actually in federal custody, and not within the Kafkaesque embrace of the District of Columbia. And indeed, as it turned out, they were. A couple of requests through the Internet, a happy conversation with the extremely helpful archivist Bill Breach, and suddenly more than 700 pages of case notes and other fascinating miscellanea arrived in a FedEx package. It was more than gratifying to be able to telephone St. Elizabeth's the next day and tell the unhelpful officials there which file I then had sitting before me on my desk. They were not best pleased. The Oxford University Press was, by contrast, wonderfully helpful. And while I'm naturally happy to thank the officials at the press who so kindly sanctioned my visits to Walton Street, I wish to acknowledge the very considerable debt that I owe first to Elizabeth Knowles, now of Oxford's Reference Books Department, who had made a study of Miner some years before and was happy to share her knowledge and access with me. I'm delighted also to be able to thank the irrepressibly enthusiastic Jenny McMorris of the Press Archives, who knows Miner and his remarkable legacy more intimately than anyone else anywhere. Jenny, together with her former colleague Peter Foden, proved a tower of strength during my visits and long after. I only hope that she manages to find an outlet for her own fascination with the great Dr. Henry Fowler, whom she rightly regards along with Murray as one of the true heroes of the English language. Several friends, as well as a number of specialists who had a professional interest in parts of the story, were kind enough to read the manuscript's early drafts, and they made many suggestions for improving it. In almost all cases, I've accepted their proposals with gratitude, but if on occasion I did, through carelessness or pig-headedness, disregard their warnings or demands, then the same caveat about the responsibility for all errors of fact, judgment, or taste remaining firmly with me applies as well. They did their best. Among those personal friends I wish to thank are Graham Boynton, Eleanor Evans, Rob Howard, Jesse Scheidlauer, Nancy Stump, Paula Schumann, and Gully Wells. And to the otherwise anonymous Anthony S., who grumbled to me that his fiancée had denied him romantic favours one summer morning because she was bent on finishing Chapter 9. My apologies, Anthony. Embarrassed thanks for your forbearance, and best wishes for future marital bliss. James W. Campbell of the New Haven Historical Society gave great assistance in finding the Miner family in their old hometown. The librarians and staff at the Yale Divinity Library told me much about William Miner's early life in Ceylon. Pat Higgins, an English woman living in Washington State, and with whom I corresponded only by email, became fascinated also by the Ceylon and Seattle ends of the Miner family story, and gave me several fascinating tips. Michael Music of the U.S. National Archives then found most of Miner's military files, and Michael Rode of the Walter Reed Army Hospital tracked down his handwritten autopsy reports. The National Park Service was helpful in giving me access to military bases in New York and Florida, where he had been stationed. The Index Project in Arlington, Virginia, assisted me in finding additional records relating to his wartime career. Susan Packies of Virginia's Orange County Tourist Office, along with the immensely knowledgeable Frank Walker, then took me around all of the important sites where the Battle of the Wilderness had been fought, and later, to cheer us all up, to several of the delightful old inns that are hidden away in this spectacularly lovely corner of the United States. Jonathan O'Neill patiently explained Civil War medical practice at the old Exchange Hotel cum Hospital that's now a museum in Gordonville, Virginia. Nancy Whitmore of the National Museum of Civil War Medicine in Frederick, Maryland, was an enthusiastic supporter of the project and painstakingly dug up a huge amount of highly relevant arcana. Dr. Lawrence Cole at the University of Alabama was kind enough to take time both to discuss the mechanics of Civil War branding and to speculate in an impressively informed way on the effects such punishments might have had on Irishmen who fought in the Union Army, the latter his particular specialty as a historian of the period. Mitchell Redman of New York City filled in some details of Miner's later personal life, about which he had once written a short but so far unproduced play. Gordon Claridge of Magdalen College, Oxford, had much that was helpful to say about the origins of mental illness. Jonathan Andrews, a historian at Broadmoor, helped also, and Issa Samad, a distinguished psychiatrist of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, told me a great deal about the history of the treatment of paranoid schizophrenia. Dale Fiore, superintendent of the Evergreen Cemetery in New Haven, then added fascinating footnotes about the end of William Miner's life, the length of his coffin, the depth at which it's buried, and the names of those who surround him in his plot. Life became a great deal easier once I had tracked down one of the few known living relatives of William Miner, Mr. John Miner of Riverside, Connecticut. He was kindness itself, giving me an enormous amount of useful information about the great-great-uncle he never knew, and offering me access to the treasure trove of pictures and papers that had sat for years undisturbed in a wooden box in his attic. He and his Danish wife Birgit became as fascinated by the story as I was, and I thank them for pleasant waterside dinners and time spent talking about the nature of their most curious relative. David Merritt, of the Merritt International Family History Society in London, gave me valuable help in ferreting out details of where George Merritt's descendants might be. I eventually found one, a Mr. Dean Blanchard in Sussex, who was equally interested in the fortunes of his distant family and shared much that was valuable with me. I am indebted also to my American agent Peter Matson, his colleague Jennifer Hengen, and to Agnes Krupp, who, once enthused by the strange nature of this story, became among its keenest supporters and kept me going, writing hard, during a long, hot American summer. And my wife, Catherine, saw to it that I remained undisturbed and offered generously the kind of serenity and sanctuary that the writing of a yarn like this more than amply deserves. Suggestions for further reading. The book that first inspired me to look into this story was Jonathan Green's Chasing the Sun, published by Jonathan Cape in London and Henry Holt in New York in 1996, and which devoted a page and a half to the tale and led me, via its bibliography, to the rather more celebrated work about the making of the OED, Caught in the Web of Words, Oxford and Yale University Presses, 1977, written by the great editor's granddaughter, K. M. Elizabeth Murray. In both cases, the tale of the first meeting between Murray and Miner relies on the well-known myth. But it was not until Elizabeth Knowles wrote a more accurate account in the quarterly journal Dictionaries that some of the truth of the encounter became more properly known. Both of the books will delight the enthusiast. The journal tends towards the academic, but since, at least superficially, the disciplines of lexicography are frankly not too taxing, many may profit from looking at it as well. For those interested in the basic principles behind the making of word books, Sidney Landau's definitive Dictionaries, The Art and Craft of Lexicography, published by Charles Scribner's Sons, New York, in 1984, is an essential read. For those iconoclasts wishing to understand the flaws in the OED, John Wilinski explains much in his rather ill-tempered Empire of Words, The Reign of the OED, published by Princeton University Press, 1994, which offers a politically correct revisionist view of James Murray's creation, albeit from a somewhat admiring stance. It is worth reading, even if just to make one's blood boil. Copies of Dr. Johnson's dictionary can usually still be found quite easily. Reproductions of the large-format, two-volume editions have been produced on presses in such unlikely settings as the city of Beirut, from where I recently purchased a copy for $250. It's difficult to find a good first edition for under $15,000, however. But there is a witty and useful distillation with words selected by E.L. McAdam and George Milne, which was published by Pantheon in New York in 1963 and in a paperback reprint by Castle of London in 1995. The Oxford University Press deserves a history of its own, and indeed has several. I recommend Peter Sutcliffe's The Oxford University Press, An Informal History, published by OUP in 1978, which covers the saga of the making of the OED very well and with reasonable impartiality. The American Civil War is, of course, very comprehensively covered. The best book relating to the fighting in which Dr. Minor played a small but for him crucial part is Gordon C. Ray's The Battle of the Wilderness, Louisiana State University Press, 1994, which I enjoyed enormously. D.P. Cunningham's 1867 classic, The Irish Brigade and Its Campaigns, has recently been reissued by Fordham University Press, New York, in 1994, with an introduction by Lawrence F. Cole, whose help with my own book I acknowledge elsewhere. Among the many books on Civil War medicine, I enjoyed George Worthington Adams's Doctors in Blue, Louisiana State University Press, 1980, and In Hospital and Camp by Harold Elk Straubing, published by Stackpole Books in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 1993. I also took some time to read the relevant chapters in that elegant giant of a book, The American Heritage: New History of the Civil War, by Bruce Catton and James McPherson, Viking, New York, 1996, which answers practically every imaginable question about the minutiae of those 4 years of bloody fighting. The nature of the possible mental ailments that plagued Dr. Minor, which may have been triggered by his experiences during the war, are comprehensively explained by Gordon Claridge in Origins of Mental Illness, ISHK Mallor Books, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1995. Andrew Scull's splendid Masters of Bedlam, Princeton University Press, 1996, offers a fascinating history of the mad doctoring trade before the times of psychiatric enlightenment. I looked to Roy Porter, also an expert on madness and its treatment, for his rightly acclaimed Social History of the City Where Minor Committed His Murder. London, A Social History, Harvard, 1994, sets the scene admirably and remains one of the best books on England's remarkable capital. But the one book that above all should be read in conjunction with this small volume is one of the biggest and most impressive works of scholarship to be found, the 12-volume first edition, the 1933 supplement, the 4 supplementary volumes of Robert Birchfield, or the fully integrated 20-volume second edition of the Oxford English Dictionary itself. It makes for an expensive and bulky set of books, which is why nowadays the CD-ROM is much preferred. But it does, most important of all to his fans, acknowledge formally the existence and contributions of Dr. Minor. And I find that somehow the simple discovery of his name, buried as it is among those of the contributors who helped make the OED the great totem that it remains today, is always an intensely touching moment. While it is, of course, in and of itself no justification for ever needing to own the great book, the finding of Minor's name presents perhaps the finest of examples of the kind of serendipitous moment for which the OED is justly famous. And few would disagree that serendipity in dictionaries is a most splendid thing indeed.